Welcome to The Art Scene, presented each week by UALR's College of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio. The University of Arkansas's Clinton School of Public Service took in its first class of students in the fall of 2004, just after the ceremonial opening of the Clinton Presidential Center. This year, 2013, sees the graduation of the seventh class of master's candidates who received their diplomas last weekend, on May the 11th. A few days before then, two members of that graduating class joined me at our radio studio, continuing what has become a feature of the art scene, the chance to meet and talk to students from each year since the Clinton School opened. This time it was two Arkansans, John Volatson from Parthenon and Andrea Price from Monticello. John earned his bachelor's degree in music at the University of Central Arkansas in Conway, spent time learning Mandarin in China, interned in former Congressman Vic Snyder's office, and worked as a volunteer following Hurricane Katrina. His international project took him to Ethiopia, helping marginalized populations, working with the Canadian Urban Institute. Andrea earned her bachelor's degree in exercise and sports science at Texas Tech University and her master's in sports science at the U.S. Sports Academy. She has worked as a science teacher, basketball and track coach in inner cities in Florida before moving back to Arkansas where her husband works at UAMS. Her international project was in Belize, where she helped establish an entrepreneurship camp for students. Both of them explain their decision to enter the Clinton School. Here's Andrea.
When I graduated, I kind of ventured out on my own and did health and wellness promotion in churches. I did worksite wellness at the University of Florida on the campus. When I moved back to Arkansas, I worked in the Delta doing health and wellness promotion with organizations there. And so I knew I couldn't be a one-woman show forever, and I researched the Clinton School, and I thought it would be a great opportunity for me to learn more about collaboration and how to do things more strategically and have more impact, so I decided to apply. So I guess my journey to the Clinton School was about learning to do things, not by myself, but with other people, to have more effect and impact.
And have you found that to be so?
Oh, definitely. I get to meet people like John and so many great people, not only my classmates, but the speakers and the staff and faculty at the school are just awesome. So it's just been a really great experience in terms of being able to network and connect with other people who are interested in having great impact on our society.
How about you, John? What made you decide to take yourself away from maybe a classical music career?
That's a long journey for me, and probably one that we don't have time to fully get into. But I think what happened for me was I came to a point where I realized I was probably not going to pursue music as a profession. And along the past few years in college, I had started to get really interested in political issues and get more involved in my community and local politics. And I'd also worked on a couple campaigns directly after college. I think like a lot of people of my generation, I was just troubled at a lot of the things going on in the country and around the world and wanted to figure out a way to make a positive difference, and was excited by the idea of doing that through the context of a career. And so some of the experiences I had after college and just looking for graduate programs when I landed on the Clinton School, it looked like a good way, like Andrea said, to kind of pursue that path and also to get a lot of experiences that maybe, like I said, I'd been in the Honors College, so I felt really prepared academically, but I hadn't had as much experience with the more collaborative side, you know, leading organizations, doing management, that kind of thing. So it just looked like a good fit all around.
Then the capstone project that you both seem to be working on, or just about completed, I imagine, I had thought that the capstone was connected to the international experience, which obviously it isn't. And it hasn't been with you two, from what I can see. But that international experience, did you find it giving more credence to what you finally chose for your capstone?
I did two very different projects for those. So for my international project, I was in Ethiopia making documentary films about an economic development organization. For my capstone project, I was in Washington, D.C. working with Democracy Corps, looking at how to increase political participation among historically underrepresented voters. I think what those two things had in common for me was they're both ways of trying to increase political participation among marginalized people and also find ways to deal with inequality problems, the poverty problems facing people both at home and abroad. And those are sort of my two passions in public service. So in the project I did for my capstone, I was looking at particularly unmarried women, young people under 30, and minorities. And these are the three groups of voters that are the most disengaged politically for a variety of reasons. And in my project, I was looking at what policies these voters are really looking for out of the federal government. What do they want to see coming out of Washington? What do they want out of their political leaders? And the idea was is that if we had a better idea what this was, what their vision for the country is, that politicians would be better able to craft policies that would resonate for them and also to message in a way that was effective. And I think it was really interesting, and I think, you know, it revealed a lot about just how far our political mainstream has gone from what the ordinary American actually wants and expects out of their government.
And for you, not obviously nearly as political as John is, but there is obviously, because of the nature of the Clinton School, there is an awareness of where the politics can be a help and how to make sure that it's used to the best way possible in your particular field, wouldn't you say?
I agree. I was fortunate enough to work for the Arkansas Community Foundation for my capstone. And one good thing about community foundations all over the United States is the fact that they can lobby. Other foundations can't. So community foundations, unlike other foundations, can be involved in the political process. So there is a connection there in terms of the philanthropic world being involved in the political process. So there is a connection, and there are fine lines between all of these different sectors that are all working to bring about some kind of social change.
So the Capstone Project, then, are they leading you into something for a career? I mean, after graduation, do you already have some kind of commitment, or are you still looking around?
I'm still looking around, but before I came to the Clinton School, I had a radio show where I focused on health and wellness promotion, and it was internet-based, and I hope to restart that after graduation in June, and this time I hope to focus on telling the stories of service, which I think oftentimes are overlooked. So that's my immediate plan post-graduation, is to continue the radio show and to share stories mm-hmm. that really can have an impact on on how we view service.
Anyway, have you got a job lined up, John?
Well, I don't have a job lined up per se. I was fortunate to have just been named a finalist in the Presidential Management Fellows Program, so that gives me a lot of opportunities to work for the federal government going forward if I want to pursue that. One problem with that right now is due to the sequester. It's not a great time to be looking for government jobs, but after the new fiscal year starts, long around September or October, I think there'll be a lot of opportunities there if I sort of want to wait that out. But I'm casting a wide net. I mean, I think one of the great things about the Clinton School is that it really exposes you to a lot of the possibilities that are out there in public service. And there really are just sort of a staggering amount. I mean, any issue you pick, any place around the world, there's exciting, interesting things being done by people. And it's just a question of kind of getting plugged into that. So that's going to be my process over the next month or two, is sort of honing where I want to be in that mix.
And you have the freedom to move anywhere you want?
Well, it would depend on the job. I mean, obviously, I would have to be able to support myself financially. And of course, that is one problem sometimes in public service paths, is sometimes the remuneration is not as high as in the private sector and other things. And I have some student debt and things like that, like many people do. So my career choice will have to be somewhat dictated by those factors, at least initially.
Pragmatic, but also idealistic.
Yeah, that's what I like to try to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, that'll be the hope. I love doing international things. I as I said, I worked in Ethiopia this summer, and prior to coming to the Clinton School, I had actually taught English in China for a year. I love China. I would love to go back to East Asia and spend some more time there learning the language and eating the food and just living that life. It was a lot of fun. But you know, my family's here in Arkansas, and so I'll always have that here. So it'll just be a kind of a question of working all those details out.
Did you find the 2 years or a year and a half that you get all this stuff crammed into your heads and into your psyche? Did you find anything, any particular speaker come up that really stood out in terms of the message, the person, and the avenues he or she opened, but just by virtue of what they do?
For me, I would say Dr. Emmett Carson, who is the president and CEO of the Silicon Valley Community Foundation, because when he came, I was actually doing my capstone project. So not only did I get to interact with him, but I got to pick his brain about maybe the direction I should take my project and his thoughts about the work I was doing at the time. So he not only came to the school as a speaker, but he also was able to mentor me during the week that he was here.
I know, and that's what time after time your fellow graduates over the years have said is just unbelievable what contact you have with these world famous people who come. Well, one young man said that to a normal college, you go in and hear the speaker in an auditorium that seats a couple of thousand people. But this is over coffee or breakfast across the table that you have a chance really to interact and get some interest, very interesting sidelights of what these people have been through to achieve what they have.
And when Dr. Carson was here, we were able to have one-on-one sessions with him during that time. So any student that wanted to meet with him and discuss anything, he was very accessible. And that was great for me. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg had just given him $500 million to his foundation. And I was able to sit and have a conversation about the gift and philanthropy. So you can't put a price on those experiences. Yeah, we have tuition at the Clinton School, but the learning and the access to information and people that we have, you just can't value it.
One or two of the early classes said there was a very open relationship between them and the teachers, the staff, the faculty, and the faculty was anxious to hear back anything that didn't quite work for some, or ideas that the students had that might open up a direction that the school hadn't thought of. Is that still happening, do you know?
Yeah, I guess I'll jump in here on that. Well, I think the Clinton School is still a young program. I mean, I think we're in the eighth year now. So one of the fun things about being there is that you get to be involved somewhat in its evolution over time. And I've definitely seen a lot of just growth and changes in the program while I've been there. And I think some of that is definitely student feedback, but then, you know, a combination of the vision that the leaders of the school have for where it goes as well. I know that we're looking into collaborations with both Oxford and Yale because they're interested in expanding their service learning capacity as well. So, yeah, it's an exciting time to be involved in the program, and I think it's got a lot of great potential for the future.
Do you have much contact with previous graduates? There's still some around, or think they come back at certain times?
One way I think we try to keep in touch is through social media. Mm-hmm. We have a Facebook page that we're able to share information. Yeah. And oftentimes past graduates will post jobs or inspirational sayings or whatever little tidbits of information they would like to share with us. We do have that kind of communication with previous classes. And every now and then we'll see some of them here in Little Rock and get to meet and interact.
How about you, John? Did you meet or sit in on sessions with somebody that seemed to be more in your field of vision than some of the others?
Well, we had, we have so many great speakers that come through there, and that's one of the real benefits of the program is just getting exposed to all those different ideas and what people are doing. For me, I guess the most obvious example would be I actually got my capstone project through the speaker series. So when Stan Greenberg came to speak, I networked with him through that and ended up getting my capstone with his organization. Stan Greenberg was Bill Clinton's pollster and also the pollster and strategist for Nelson Mandela and Tony Blair and some others. And so that was obviously a great connection. And I got to go to DC and work with GQR and Democracy Corps, which is his public opinion polling and strategy group, and that's what I did my capstone with. So that was obviously an important connection for me.
And who knows where it will lead.
Right.
Well, that applies to both of you, doesn't it? To anybody who is on the threshold of something with ideas burgeoning and with a fairly impressive background as a result of some of the things you've done, both before, but particularly this visit to Little Rock.
Right.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's great to be here.
Arkansans John Volitson from Parthenon and Andrea Price from Monticello were my guests a few days before they received their master's degrees in public service from the University of Arkansas Clinton School of Public Service in Little Rock on May the 11th, 2013. They are members of the seventh class of graduates since the Clinton School opened in November 2004.
Here's a look at what's happening in the arts in Arkansas. This afternoon at 2, the Arkansas Festival Ballet presents the last performance of The Adventures of Pinocchio at the Arkansas Art Center's Children's Theater. Opening Tuesday at Murray's Dinner Playhouse, Steel Magnolias shows every day except Mondays through June 15th. Opening Wednesday at the Walton Art Center in Fayetteville, War Horse shows each evening through Saturday and matinees on Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday. Thursday at the Fine Arts Club of Arkansas meeting, gallery owner Greg Thompson will talk about the art of collecting Southern art, 11 a.m. at the Arkansas Art Center. Friday, the Central Arkansas chapter of the American Guild of Organists presents organist Scott Detra at Christ Episcopal Church. Concert starts at 8 p.m. May is Arkansas Heritage Month. The theme this year is Saving Our Heritage, Arkansas's Historic Structures. There are many exhibits and events in different parts of the state. You can learn about them at arkansasheritage.com. On display around Central Arkansas at the Old State House Museum, Things You Need to Hear, Memories of Growing Up in Arkansas. At the Arkansas Art Center, Paul Signac, Watercolors and Drawings, the James T. Dyke Collection. And opening Friday at the Art Center, Bauhaus 2021, An Ongoing Legacy, photographs by Gordon Watkinson. And opening Wednesday at the UALR Galleries, Sacred Symbols and Sequins, Vintage Haitian Voodoo Flags. And that's a look at the arts calendar for this week. For more on what's going on in Arkansas, visit our online calendar at ualrpublicradio.org.
My next guest this week is Gary Powell, associate professor in the UCA Writing Department. Stoning the Devil is his first published novel, and he was a featured author in the 10th Arkansas Literary Festival last month. From England, he is a graduate of Cambridge University and the University of Durham. He has led a peripatetic life, teaching English in language schools in Spain and Poland, in the Middle East and Portugal. And his novel, set in the United Arab Emirates, draws vividly from the years he spent there. Each chapter is complete in itself, and several have appeared as short stories in various magazines, but the characters within them bind the whole. The cover of his book is from a photograph he took himself, a desert scene, a striking reflection of the stories to come.
That was the idea, yeah. In fact, the photograph was purely fortuitous. I didn't take it for the purpose of finding a cover. In truth, the characters there are brother and sister. They're not actually a term, but I think it's an evocative picture.
And that's another interesting connection, because the young Badria, her older brother Sultan, is in the last chapter.
Mm-hmm.
But he's more in the last chapter as a drawn figure, and a most unpleasant one, really.
Yes, yes.
Some of the things that you talk about in this book, stoning, which is in the title, Stoning the Devil, and the dreadful descriptions of coming out of the Middle East, of how they bury particularly women up to the neck and then stone them to death.
It's not very common, actually, but it doesn't happen in the UAE at all. But yes, it has happened.
Is it a more relaxed community altogether? Because those characters, the young women, seem to have access to all sorts of things without being punished for them.
Yes. I mean, they're taking risks, but the UAE is certainly more liberal than Saudi Arabia. But I think everywhere in the Middle East now, women are leading freer lives. Technology is giving women a lot of freedom. Cell phones particularly have given women a lot of opportunities to make contacts and maintain a social life with people. So they can get about, and they're not really trapped in the home. And one of the things I was interested in exploring in the book was the way women were leading freer lives and trying to seize that freedom, really, leading a quite assertive lives. Because in the Western media, we usually hear about women leading very passive, submissive lives. And that wasn't really my experience in the Middle East.
The thing that comes out also is the absolute passionate interest that the young women particularly have in what women are doing in America and in the West and the freedom they have and what they explore.
Yes.
And they're pushing boundaries in terms of sexual freedom and testing the water to the point of danger if they were caught doing some of the things they did. Some of your characters, particularly Alia, who is Badria's cousin and features in the first chapter because she is the recipient of a letter from the younger girl as to what's happened to her and what they try to pass it off as. They just don't seem to have a place to fit in the life that they're trying to find for themselves. They're not Western girls. They're not really as comfortable as their mothers would have been in the setting in the United Arab Emirates.
That's true.
And they are absolutely passionately fascinated by sex.
Mm-hmm.
And the detail that you go, it's sort of, I don't quite know, does that come under the title erotica, the way you go into the details?
Well,
Gary?
You know, I think erotica for me has connotations of pornography, and I certainly would like to think that it's not pornographic.
Well, why do you go into such detail?
What I'm trying to do, I'm not trying to excite the reader, which I think is what pornography does.
In fact, it turns you off.
Right. What I'm trying to do is look without flinching at what happens in order to understand the power dynamics, in order to understand the sexual politics. And you're right that the in a society which is as sexually repressed as this, the whole society, it's incredibly erotically charged, the whole atmosphere of life there. I've never been anywhere where people were so fascinated by sex, where people thought about sex so much. Remember that I didn't really interact with local women in groups.
Your other Western conference club that you belong to or something.
Yeah, we certainly discussed it. But remember that our contacts with locals were largely one-on-one. And people are a little afraid to speak openly. So they will generally only open up to you and really divulge what they think about things when you are strictly alone with them and feel that they trust you. I taught on a women's campus of a university. So I had a lot of contact with young women, and they were certainly as interested in sex and love as Western women are.
And you have one chapter very much involved with Alia and, is it Colin, in the classroom, where she tries passionately to entice him.
Yeah, she tries to seduce him. You know, believe it or not, that was not that uncommon. The girls frequently had crushes on professors and tried to seduce them.
Well, that's natural even in the Western society. Yeah. And somebody's close and seems to feel a sympathy or an empathy discussing subjects and things. But Colin, I think it was, that was the Englishman who was being sort of seduced, but he was also on the prowl. He was married to a very unhappy woman who was she from the Arab Emirates?
No, she
was a Middle Easterner, wasn't she?
Yeah, she grew up in Lebanon. She's a Palestinian refugee from Lebanon, like Randa and Marwan.
And they are disturbed people just from birth, virtually, because they don't know where they belong.
Yes, to some extent. And also they went through the trauma of the civil war in Lebanon in the 80s. So they're heavily traumatized. These particular people grew up in the refugee camps and have seen members of their family being murdered.
And this also is where you bring in a time frame that you have to read a chapter for a minute to think, now, what was this person doing and how long ago could it have been that it happened? And it's not often that you give a clue, like with the Badria, say specifically that she's 20 when she's at university. And then her cousin Alia is impregnated and knows that this is absolutely the most dreadful thing that could happen to her, even if the Emirates are slightly more relaxed in a totality compared with the neighboring Arab countries, and tries desperately to bring about an abortion. And the descriptions of the desert and the area are just nightmarish, the way you've written it up.
Yes.
And the next thing you know is she's married to Sultan. And obviously soon enough that she can bear the child and fool him to think he is the father.
Mm-hmm.
And you think this is the one that's in the chapter when she's trying to get rid of it. He's the last person she wants to have anything to do with.
Exactly. Yeah.
But you have some wonderfully descriptive passages. There's one I wanted you to read, I think, because it is so attractive. Where Colin is out and he suddenly stops on a bridge and looks.
Oh, yeah. It's in Unveiled, which is about the third or fourth story. And this particular passage is in England. This is at the beginning of their marriage.
Yes.
It's some years before they're in the Emirates, actually.
And this is when whatever sort of romance there may have been between him and his wife has worn off.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Motionless on the unrippled river are two white swans. Till now, Colin has been watching and listening as if he were in a cinema, numbly. But all of a sudden, his other senses come into play. He smells a whiff of petrol, the damp stone of the bridge, the leaves, the grass on the river bank. He feels the breeze lift his hair. The swans are as luminous as the moon against the black background of the water, and as he observes them, his thoughts are stilled. He is aware without shaping the awareness into words. This is what he has striven for so long, and here it is, uncalled for, a moment of grace. He turns to Fairuz. She is fidgeting, lips pursed, urging him to hurry, but all his irritation is gone.
Mm-hmm. A memory.
Yes.
And he obviously is not quite sure where he stands with her, is still attracted to her, but she, as with the other women who don't really belong, the Polish girl, Sonia...
Camila. Yeah, she calls herself Sonia.
And she is the subject of one of the chapters that has the most horrific description of what happens to her because she's plying her trade to make money as a prostitute in the hotel. You don't really find out what happens to her except she was expecting to go to prison and she probably did.
Mm-hmm.
And then the maitre d' at the hotel who'd helped her, the next time you see him, he's working in a massage parlor or a Turkish bath or something. And has obviously been downgraded by his employers because he has stepped out of line when he shouldn't have done.
Yeah, he tried to help her. Yeah.
You leave the reader to figure that out because you don't go into details.
Right. Not all of the ends are tied up. There are some gaps which the reader has to fill in for himself.
And that, of course, makes for a good short story because it leaves the reader guessing.
Yes.
Where in the novel form, you're expecting to have some kind of reference further into the book to what happens and what happens to her in the end. She probably doesn't have much to say because women are obviously literally the chattels that the society has demanded. You don't get much of the community that you belonged to as a teacher from the West, Britain or America or wherever, teaching English as a second language. Was that something that you found when you were at Cambridge?
Oh, I certainly wasn't. When I was at Cambridge, I was more interested in Latin Europe, which was where I went, actually. I was influenced, as a lot of young men with literary aspirations are, by particularly Hemingway, and I headed for Spain and Portugal. The Middle East did exert a sort of subterranean influence on me. I think it was more the David Lean film, Lawrence of Arabia, actually, which Colin has that fascination as well in the book, just as Durrell with the Alexandria Quartet gives you a sort of panorama of Egyptian life in the last days of the empire. I try to do the same in the post-colonial period for the Gulf. Colin, who is, you know, far from a totally sympathetic figure, does at least have some sort of ethical quandary. On the one hand, he wants to think of himself as a champion of the Arabs, as a liberal, as an anti-colonialist. But on the other hand, certainly his wife sees him in some ways as an orientalist of the old stamp, as someone who's suffering from perhaps subconscious racism.
Do you say you've had some good responses to your book?
The reviews on Amazon have all been 5 stars, so that's been nice.
Mm-hmm. Now, was it printed in England or
I'm not sure where it was printed. It's published by an English publisher, Skylight Press. I think it's printed on both sides of the Atlantic, actually.
Gary Powell is associate professor in the writing department at the University of Central Arkansas in Conway. His novel, Stoning the Devil, is published in paperback by Skylight Press. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR's College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio.